Good evening.
Ah.
I remembered at the last minute to say something other than hello in my typical fashion.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I came up with, and apparently I came in a little too hot.
It startled me.
Yeah. Well, good.
Yeah. Well,
get some energy going there.
Yeah, a little pep in my step. Wake up call, etc. Splash of cold water in the face. So.
Yeah. I don't know why you're talking like that.
I don't know.
Like a detective from the 50s.
Well, it's better than a detective who grew up watching 1980s cheesy cop shows.
Aha, uh-huh. See, look, you did a segue. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I'm awake. Awake I am. Awake is me. But so
awake is you.
Yeah.
Are we throwing you off because it's the wrong day of the week?
I don't know. Everything's the wrong day of the week this week. But we watched Suicide Squad, and then we watched Birds of Prey, the 2020 film, which is something that just barely registers on my mind as something that existed in 2020. For some reason, I thought this was like a 2019 film or something. Like, it feels much more pre-COVID than it is actually. Part of its screening in Asia ran up against some theater closures because of COVID, the start of it. So it's just sort of surprising in that way that it was not so very long ago that this came out into existence.
January 2020. So I guess it was Mexico City, February 7th in the United States. So that's technically pre-COVID-ish in the United States.
Yeah,
really.
It's just like a month. And a month later, everything was closed and people were hiding in their homes with a bunch of groceries and paper goods that they were huddling around to protect them.
Yeah.
But
all the bread and all of the paper towels.
Couldn't put
Humpty Dumpty. No, that was different.
All the active dry yeast.
Was there a run on? There was a run on yeast.
There was
I
a run on
that.
Yeast.
Yeah.
Remember when everybody was making sourdough because they couldn't get yeast? And
I do remember that.
Yeah, and then everybody's just like, "Screw this." And I would just politely observe that there are far fewer people making sourdough bread these days than there were a year ago. But missed out on this, I guess, because we were just so caught up in living in the moment at the time. But this didn't appeal to me, that it was Harley Quinn off of the Suicide Squad movie that I also didn't see or have any interest in seeing. Also didn't make me want to go out there and see it. The trailer seemed more interesting than the Suicide Squad because it was sort of this saturated, bright, peppy thing in comparison to what has been traditionally viewed as sort of a dark and somber DC universe, and sort of the original Suicide Squad movies, dark and punk, for lack of a more accurate term.
Harley's always been the most colorful and energetic and, dare I say, interesting portion of the DC universe thus far.
Yeah. And So I didn't have any lofty expectations. I knew that several people had told me that, oh, this is better than Suicide Squad. This is the best DC movie that they've made. More people would say, like, oh, Wonder Woman's the best DC movie they've made, and this is the, you know, second best or whatever.
Where do you come down on that debate?
Did you see
the various Wonders Woman?
I did wind up seeing Wonder Woman 84. The WW 84.
Did you watch the first one though?
I watched the first one. Yeah. Okay. I saw that one in theaters when it came out.
You saw it in theaters.
Yeah, I didn't remember theaters.
I don't know that I would go to a theater to see Wonder Woman. I actually, now that I'm saying that, maybe I did too, but I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, it was so long ago. Who could say? But I liked the first Wonder Woman up until the requisite Zack Snyder action third act barf fest.
I definitely remember what the third act of that movie was.
It's just a lot of punching and fighting and I'm a god and you should be a god and rule with me and blah blah blah, blah. This is stupid.
Who's the bad guy?
The bad guy was the guy who was pretending to be your friend but was secretly Ares, the god of war, who was stoking all the World War stuff because he was so evil and wanted people to fight. Hilariously, it was World War One, and the whole entire time I was watching the movie, I'm just like, they know there's another one of these world wars that happens immediately following this, and that it would be weird to sort of say like, oh, now we've fixed world wars, like in a historical fashion. But
I just really wanted to do the art design from the first one. So
no, I think they wanted to set it apart from Captain America. Yeah. Because the first Captain America movie, Captain America, the first Avenger, he is in World War II. But I don't really super duper care about that. It was just sort of interesting watching her do her thing. The mechanics of the story weren't that great. And then the Wonder Woman 84 was not as bad as I was expecting it to be. But yeah, it all just kind of falls apart at the end and just is sad. It's a sort of a sad, embarrassing ending for everyone, I think. I wasn't 84?
That movie, my memory of that movie is that it is very long, and it starts off with some 80s nostalgia, and it's very well art directed to match the 80s, but then very quickly that is no longer a redeeming factor for it because the rest of the movie is poopy.
I think it just didn't really know how to tie everything together. I appreciate the fact that she did not have a knockdown drag out fight with Pedro Pascal at the end, but spoiler alert, I guess, for Wonder Woman 84.
He was connected to the big glowy machine, so
he stepped inside the transmission thing to transmit so that he could touch everybody to do the wish thing so he could siphon their life force or something. They never made the mechanics of what was at stake in that movie very clear. This stuff with Cheetah started out interesting with the way they were doing things, but then it just turned into barf by the time you got around towards the end of the film.
She had the cool gold suit.
Yeah, it wasn't that cool. It didn't make any sense.
Like, I had
it wasn't
an action figure when I was a kid that had a gold suit that looked like that, but it wasn't Wonder Woman.
No, it's possible. I feel like there were a lot of things in the 80s that were sort of like a chrome-ish plated plastic. Silverhawks?
Yes. We've talked about this before. Yeah, you sent me a trailer or something. I vaguely remember it.
Yeah. Wings of Metal, Nerves of Steel. Silverhawks. Anyway, so...
But steel is a metal, so why would you delineate the two? If one was stronger than the other, why wouldn't they both be steel and both be just metal?
It's the lyrics for the opening scene, Dan, for a 1980s children's cartoon show made by Rankin Bass. It doesn't need to make sense. Mm-hmm. We've digressed from talking about this movie. So where does this stand in the pantheon of things? I will withhold my judgment until we talk about this further, but I will say I will say that it is not good. It is not bad. It is something that needs another pass, I think, and it would have been probably pretty good if they just tightened up some... not even tightened up, rearranged some things. I feel like the movie's pretty tight. It doesn't have a lot of, like, flabby middle section parts where everybody's just sort of like, boop, boop. But it is...
Although, to be honest, when she does the... Jumping ahead a little bit here. When she does the... when she gets smacked around and goes into her little, like, loopy fest and starts doing the... whatever that song is, where she's dressed like Marilyn Monroe or whatever. Mm-hmm. That part, I was like, why is this here? Are we padding the movie now? Luckily, it doesn't last very long. But as soon as that happened, I was like, peculiar.
Yeah, I feel there were several choices in this that... can render the film a little distracting from the overall story it's trying to tell and the sort of points it's trying to make in some areas. It is an ensemble cast. It is vaguely about Harley Quinn. In the sort of pseudo title of this, it is Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, which is not how it's depicted everywhere whenever you see the title, because I don't think most people want to type all that out. But yeah. it is largely centered on her, but there's a cast of characters surrounding this that make it all happen. And unfortunately, the movie has a very cliched introduction to this sort of voiceover storytelling. I don't know.
You don't like the TLDR animated intro credits thing where we get her life story summed up in a quippy little background illustrated in 2D animation?
I thought that was fine, but what I didn't like was we should probably start at the beginning. Too far? And it's like, no, you can't do that. This is like a huge cliche.
Oh, that one, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, continuing to poke fun and pretend that we're not over it by going like, let me take you back a few days and all right, let's bring you back to reality and hang on, I gotta go back to explain something else. I think my primary comment to you while we were watching this is that there was the reason I've seen this movie before, but the reason that I don't remember I remember why I don't remember anything, which is because there's too much jumping around for me to hold all of these bits and pieces in my head at one time, so I can't reassemble the linear story in my head most of the time. So I just forget about stuff until they show back up. Because I did see this movie. I generally remembered. Actually, that's not true. I forgot Ewan McGregor was even in this movie, to be honest. As soon as he popped up on screen, I was like, oh, right, he's the bad guy. And then Chris Messina's there. It's like, right, Chris Messina with the blonde hair and the weird thing and the scars and stuff. And then I knew Singer Girl was there. And then I forgot about Rosie Perez. Here and then I forgot about what was the Scott Pilgrim girl,
mm-hmm. Mary Elizabeth Winstead,
who's very tall compared to everyone else in the movie.
Yes. So I think it's worth mentioning sort of the production part of this first,
is there background and story?
Well, it just kind of, I think, helps explain some of it. There were a few Harley Quinn things going on around the time that Suicide Squad was in production, and Margot Robbie was attached to this one in particular as the producer. They worked on it with this screenwriter until it got into a shape that the studio was willing to go ahead further with it. And Margot Robbie insisted that it needed a woman director. And so they worked on that, and then they got Kathy Yan, and Kathy Yan liked the story and wanted, you know, sort of this against the patriarchy kind of vibe that was in there, and just sort of like massaged it a little bit. She says that she did not have final cut on the picture, and that she wishes that there was a, you know, cut of this movie out there that was fully in her control, but it is what it is.
And it is DC, and they're unlike Marvel, who has an iron grip on their final cut because they needed to fit into a larger universe of things. DC has an iron grip on their final cuts because they are trying to committee the bejesus out of this in the hopes that they can become a Marvel.
Yeah, well, they just have a bunch of people who, you know, feel like they got a sense of what'll make it like a Marvel, and like had a focus group tested into oblivion and stuff. So I don't know in what particular way that steered the production of this film or the editorial choices that were made. There were reshoots at one point after this, but it doesn't seem like it's a troubled production. It's just whatever stamp DC put on this that wasn't what Kathy Yan wanted to do, Yan has not elaborated on.
Was this in development before Suicide Squad? Is that what you said?
During Suicide Squad.
Okay, so it's likely that when Suicide Squad came out and pooped the bed, that they kind of had a bit of a last minute panic rethink on this.
I'm assuming that's why this is also a lighter tone.
Well, I mean, it kind of, yeah, by nature of the characters and content, should be a lighter tone. I mean, I don't think any manner of reshoots is going to make Ewan McGregor into what he is here. Like, he was silly all the way through, like,
I wasn't saying they corrected it to make it light. It's not like Suicide Squad, where they tried to, like, lighten it up after they made the movie.
They didn't send this to the trailer house to punch it up.
No, this was light during the production of this. Like, it was not a... I feel like that's what they... The lesson they learned from what they were doing with Suicide Squad is that they wanted this to be sort of light and fun.
But a lot still of it has violent. To be in the script still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like, you know... The script has some moments. It's not a particular, like, nobody has any, like, particularly memorable lines or witty dialogue that's really going to, like, sit with you or, you know, you'll think is funny and chuckle about to yourself later. So it's
not the crossbow killer.
Yeah.
Huntress.
Like, it's just like a, it's sort of like a level of mild amusement is what some of the stuff brings.
I feel like that's kind of, Harley Quinn's vibe in general. Like, she is like her existence is like impulsed by and just like drunken relentless positivity, like buying the hyena, and you know, she's got very much like over caffeinated, over sugared college kid vibes, but like as an adult with weapons and things. So, you know, the lightness kind of springs from that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say also that everything around her is light. Like, even our bad guy, Ewan McGregor's Roman, what's his last name?
Cyanus?
Cyanus.
It's like the back pain, but not quite.
Who plays Black Mask. And
they announce in the beginning of the movie as Black Mask, and then you totally forget about it until the very end, where he dramatically grabs his mask and you're like, oh right, you got a secret name identity thing.
Yeah, I feel like they squandered that. He could have been any crime boss. It didn't. And the touches that Ewan put on this were not specific to any depiction of Black Mask.
I don't know anything about Black Mask, but I could probably bet that he's not this like deeply insecure psychopath who likes to cut the faces off people.
Well, he is deeply insecure, and he is a psychopath, and he doesn't cut the faces off of people as much as he. There was a whole thing with chemicals and stuff, but they probably like changed it to cutting the faces off because it makes it more distinct from the Joker. Legally distinct, because there's a lot of similarity if you read up on sort of the history of Black Mask. He's a, you know, crime boss kind of guy, and he's got his henchmen and stuff.
An agent of chaos, perhaps.
And he's got his, well, he's not an agent of chaos as much as he is somebody who wants to like take down the two-faced, well, not two-faced, because that's a different villain. He wants to take down the people who sort of like wear a mask in public about what their, you know, their thing is, all the rich people out there. And he especially hates his parents. He kills his parents by burning them alive. In the movie, his parents fired him from the Janus Corporation company, and then he goes off to do this thing, and they don't really talk about his parents at all. So it's a completely separate thing from that. But I would have to say that the character of Black Mask is not so well defined in the American public's mind that it needs to be any one particular thing. Like this is fine in terms of the depiction of him. It just is, I think, maybe a wasted opportunity for it to be something specific about Black Mask instead of just any other crime boss.
A wacko guy who has a penchant for velvet blazers and leather driving gloves.
Yeah, did you appreciate his driving gloves?
I did, yes. I mean, if you're gonna, you know, be getting your hands dirty with the kind of stuff he's doing, I feel like that's a reasonable thing to do. Plus, pre-COVID times, you know, you want to stay safe.
Yeah, I mean, I like that they kind of made him sort of, like kind of a hypochondriac in some ways, like doesn't want to get blood on him, doesn't like a snot bubble, etc. Like he he has like certain like things, these weird superficial things that lead into these homicidal tics of his.
He's a demented rich kid at heart.
Yeah, and I think you and Nail doing that, whether or not that's the assignment of Black Mask, I would say probably not, but it is it's fine. For what it is,
he's entertaining.
Yeah.
And he's believable. Well, within this world, he's believable with what he's doing.
Yeah. Although I don't understand his criminal empire, because they make it out to seem like he runs Gotham, but he's also afraid of the Joker. So doesn't the Joker run Gotham? Who runs Gotham?
I think he relies on a lot of freelancers, because, you know, at the end there with the large mob of people, he's basically like calling in favors, saying like, I did you a solid. Now I'm cashing in all of my favors at once here for all of you people who also wear masks for some inexplicable reason to go get, the kid.
Yeah, he has some sort of gang in the comics. I can't remember the name of it. It's like the Faceless Society or something. I think that's some of supposedly probably why they're wearing masks in this. But he doesn't necessarily follow anything from earlier wherein he kills the golden what was the other competing crime family's name, whatever.
Yeah, the face guy who we didn't really need to see cut back and forth the way we saw it, but one was the least annoying because it was the shortest scene, but it was still too long.
Yeah, but it doesn't integrate into any part of the story other than showing us that he likes to cut off faces, and that he is sort of indiscriminate in his violence, but it doesn't do anything for us in terms of he needed this family in order to do something, or this is part of the process of this thing, or any of that stuff. So I don't necessarily understand what we gain as having that particular thing as part of the story, him gaining power.
The extent of his motivation is that he both simultaneously believes that he owns everyone and everything in the city just because he is who he is, and also he wants to go take everything from other people because he believes that it is his and other people have it accidentally or something. Like he's disconnected from reality in his head there a little bit. And he just assumes that the rest of it belongs to him, and he's just going to go about taking it and killing people that are in his way, which is, about as much motivation as a character like this really needs. Like he doesn't have to have some sort of deep in depth convoluted plot or whatever. He's just a demented rich kid who just thinks everything belongs to him and he's going to kill people and torture them and stuff.
Yeah, and his in movie BFF, described as a BFF, Chris Messina, who he has incredibly strange sexual tension with in some scenes, they have a weird dynamic where Chris Messina is the killer who kills all the people for Black Mask, but at the same time, Chris Messina is also sort of a bumbling idiot in other aspects of crime things, and is just sort of like a wanton murderer. So it's sort of sloppy.
You mean
that he's
bumbling just in his general demeanor, or because he gets pickpocketed, or what?
Gets pickpocketed. He doesn't spot that all of the stuff has been conspicuously leaking out with like secrets to things. Until it's like too late. He's just not as on top of it as you would expect a number two henchman to be. And he does get taken out relatively quickly at the end of the film before the big fight.
You almost expect him to like pop back up because he's not even really portrayed as like a tough guy or anything. He's just kind of sadistic and likes using knives and stuff.
Yeah. And I'm not as familiar with that particular comic book character. It is one.
He's really actually a character?
Yeah, and it is like that, where he cuts himself after his victims, etc. Blah 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 blah. But I don't think anybody really knows or cares. It seems fine for what it is. But then we have our like cast of sort of heroes, I guess, anti-hero slash heroes. Our crew of misfits for the film, and
misfit, underappreciated, female characters who are underappreciated and underestimated, I guess.
Yes. And unfortunately, I feel like the movie does them a disservice in the way that it chooses to dole out their exposition, with these weird cutaways to entire sequences that are about them, and then like jumping back into the story of the film, which I find distracting, both in terms of like trying to make us feel anything about them, because that feels like it's its own disconnected thing from what we're watching, and also in terms of how it's supposed to make me feel about the story that we're watching, because it disrupts the storytelling process in order to go do that digression.
So this, it's interesting because we've often, I think even last week, talked about how it would be nice to get some additional character development of certain characters in the movie. And in this movie, they do give us additional character development, and it is entertaining to go over and watch these people and get to know them a little bit and find out what their world's all about and how they're underappreciated and how they're fitting in with the world. And it's all interesting. I think the part where it falls down, A, because of the non-linear jumping around, and you know, they tried to make it cutesy with, you know, Harley telling the story and jumping around and stuff. I mean, I'm not saying they should have like front loaded the whole movie with everyone's backgrounds or whatever, but the real reason it falls down is because most of these characters are kind of inconsequential to the story itself. Like, you know, whatever, Montoya is a cop or whatever, and she gets the, you know, the tip off or whatever, and she's trying to help. She's familiar with the girl, whatever, because she's a pickpocket, and like she's coming at it from that angle. And Huntress is trying to get the diamond because it's part of her family fortune and stuff. And then, you know, Singer Girl knows Harley or whatever. So like they have a reason to come in contact with each other, but their backgrounds, while illuminating a little bit more about why they are the way they are, that it doesn't ultimately make a difference to what actually occurs in the movie. They just sort of become, not even friends, like, yeah, acquaintances. I mean, they become friends sort of like in the ending montage or whatever, but it doesn't really make a difference to the story. So while the characters are fleshed out, like, who cares? Also, like, it's entertaining, I guess, which, I mean, maybe you could say that about the whole movie, that it's like entertaining, but who cares? So that's the only thing for me. It's like, we spend a lot of time jumping around and learning about these people. We could jump around with a little bit more efficiency, I think, but also, at the end of it, like, great, we understand these people and where they're coming from, but now what? It's just, you know, group melee battle at the amusement park.
Well, I would push back a little and say that I feel like Montoya and Canary get better characterizations because some of what's happening with their characters happens in the course of the main narrative of the film.
Yeah.
As opposed to happening entirely off screen, we get almost nothing of Canary as like a cutaway thing, except for her doing the stage singing thing, which,
yeah, she's pretty well intertwined with the plot.
Yeah. It had they just put that in part of the beginning of the movie in normal time for the film, which I will refer to as normal time. If they had put that as part of the flowing structure of the film, I feel like it would have sat in there and worked better. That characterization would have woven in with everything by moving it to happen later in the film, but still be part of the main plot. I think it does it a disservice, and it does make it feel like it's something separate when it's not. Whereas with Huntress, her backstory is so dissociated from everything that's happening, because all of the people that are involved in the story of the Huntress are off screen. They're not a part of this story. That,
except Chris Messina, who is part of the story, but we don't learn that he's part of the whole thing until the very end.
Yes, exactly. And that there is a plot device, a MacGuffin sort of, where the thing that's inside of the film has to do with her family.
Yeah.
But it is not the thing she is after. You'd mentioned earlier she was after the diamond. She's not after the diamond. She's after revenge.
Also, as an aside, I was reading through the Wikipedia plot again because I watched the movie yesterday, but I just wanted to be as fresh as possible. There's a line in the Wikipedia plot summary that says it's not just that it's a large diamond, but the diamond has account numbers etched on it for the family fortune.
How did you miss that, Dan?
Is that in the movie?
Yes, that's in the movie.
When do they say that? Because I absolutely did not hear that either time I watched this movie.
It's when Harley is talking about the Bertinelli massacre and the diamond.
So it's only in the voiceover flashback. At no point does Huntress ever say, like, hey, can I get the numbers off that diamond, please?
No, it's in the voiceover flashback, and it's also in the end of the picture where they have the diamond and Harley escapes with Black Canary's car, and then in voiceover reveals that they got the account codes off of the diamond, which Harley would have had to have given to them outside of what we saw depicted in the film, because
so she took the fortune and funded their little Birds of Prey force, and Harley just
kept the diamond.
Hawked the diamond itself for the value, which I guess I got that, but I didn't. I missed the part where the diamond had the account numbers etched into it.
Yes, it had them etched into it. I believe the line is something like "on a molecular level," which is hilarious. But they
stupid is what it is. Stupid.
Yeah, they did that thing, and so that's why everybody's after this diamond. It's not because the diamond itself is super valuable, but because the account number's written on it. How the diamond came into the possession of Black Mask is not a part of the film that I remember, other than Chris Messina has to go pick it up. But why he has to go pick it up is also not evident to me in the course of the events of the film. So I don't understand that part of it necessarily, because if you had that diamond and you knew that it was valuable because of what was written in it, wouldn't you have used those account codes to get that money? Why are you doing it now? I don't feel like that is satisfactorily explained, or if it was and I missed it, I apologize, but it is a very big question mark.
To go pick up the diamond and meet him at his bad guy bank so they can do the transfer or something.
Yeah, but like, why do they suddenly have the diamond now to do this thing? Why did who went to the bank to put it in the bank deposit box so that they could go get it and then to go do this? Like, why was it just sitting there if he knew that there were account numbers on it?
Yeah. Did he know that there were account numbers on it? What one would assume.
One would assume that's why he thought it was so valuable, but they don't even
broach
that subject.
It's also just a large diamond. And then when Chris Messina gets the diamond and he's like looking at it, like holding it up to his eye, you know, you just kind of assume like he's looking at it because it's a diamond, and like that's what people do in movies when they check out a diamond. They look at it real close to inspect it for purity or something.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. All we know, and I think this is a frustrating part that's evident in several points in the film, all we know is from the voiceover, and we don't know how much of what we hear in the voiceover is actually something that the characters in the movie know, because we're hearing a voiceover that is in the past tense after the events of the film, and how Harley knew those things is never made clear, and how the people in the movie know these things is never made clear, but we in the audience know those things because Harley tells us.
Right, that's a good point. Like, how did Harley know that the account numbers were on the diamond unless Huntress told her, but Huntress wouldn't have probably told her because it doesn't make any sense.
Or Canary knew because she overheard that, but how does Canary know? I don't understand necessarily just how that all maps out, nor do I really super duper care. But it does provide a level of complication in terms of like making this convoluted
you can tell how they had to back solve some of the stuff. That it's like, well, it's her family's fortune. Well, why didn't she just get her family's fortune when her family was murdered? It's like, well, because they assumed the daughter was murdered as well, because they had to hide her, otherwise that she would have actually been really murdered. So she was raised as a non Bertolli, Bertinelli, whatever the hell their family was.
Bertinelli, the Valerie.
Yeah, sure, she was raised as a non-Bertinelli.
Deserved a bigger laugh. Do you remember Valerie Bertinelli? She has a cooking channel show and everything.
I don't think she's part of the... Maybe she had to resort to cooking channel when she lost her family's fortune.
She was even a joke in the movie Saved. Remember? She had the Lifetime stuff. Anyway, so...
I have not seen Saved in a very long time, and oh boy, do I not want to watch that movie.
It's all just kind of sloppy.
Yeah, so like the reason the money didn't come to her is because it would have in the will if her parents died, but they had to pretend that she was dead, so she went off to Sicily and got really good at fighting, while the money of her family just went into a trust that was...
No. The money that her family had inside of those accounts was unknown to everybody else, because account numbers are how you get to the money. Without those numbers, you don't get the money. It's not like going to Bank of America and saying, "I'm sorry, my parents died. Please give me all their money."
The idea, but I, yeah. Well, obviously I don't need to like nitpick the actual reality of this situation, but the idea that a bank account number is so permanent that it could be etched onto a diamond for posterity is absurd on the face of it.
Well, yes.
I know my checking account number hasn't changed in the past like 20 years, but I'm not exactly relying on that to be the method by which I hand things down to future generations.
Yeah, also, you would think that you would put the numbers onto something that was less valuable for stealing.
Sure. Why not? It's the last place anyone would look. Nobody would expect you to deface a $2 million diamond or whatever the hell it is with account numbers and lasers.
Yes. No one expects maybe it's, lasers.
Maybe the account number was derived by looking at the natural molecular structure of the diamond, and they didn't actually write the numbers on the diamond. The diamond told them the numbers to ask the bank for.
They asked the universe, what should my bank account number be? Exactly, and the diamond spoke to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because no two diamonds are alike.
No. Anyway, we have this convoluted plot of trying to reveal these characteristics about all of these various characters while trying to have a linear story unfold.
I forgot one more thing that I wanted to get back to. So mm-hmm. we were talking about the extensive backstories and sort of undercutting because it's ultimately inconsequential. And you did bring up the very good point that technically Canary was interwoven into the plot in such a way that her involvement makes sense. What doesn't really work for me and undercuts her existence in the movie is the third act. Oh, by the way, she also has superpowers that we kind of hinted at with one line earlier in the movie, but up until now have not explored. So she can scream away everybody.
In her flashback to the beginning of the picture sequence where she's introduced, she sings at such a pitch that it destroys the martini glass that Black Mask had.
Yes.
Scene.
People have done that.
Yeah. And, you know, you could interpret it that way. And then, we have the line from Montoya about it. But I think this might be a situation where, because I knew of the character beforehand, I was sort of waiting the entire time for when she was going to do it. Whereas
you're really more familiar with the DC universe than I thought.
Evidently, but I mean, only barely. I was just waiting for her to use the power earlier in the film. I understand why they waited until the end to make it like a big thing. But like you said, if you were someone who was unfamiliar with Black Canary, you may be a little thrown by the suddenness of it.
Also her hesitance to use it. Like, why didn't that come out earlier? She just didn't want to reveal herself as somebody who has power?
No, because after she did that, she passed out on the ground, and she wasn't in the film until they went to the taco stand later.
So she's like a superhero with narcolepsy.
This is something that the movie could have, I guess, spelled out for us in some way. If we had seen her use a fraction of her power earlier and saying like she needed to hold back or something because otherwise she'd pass out, then it would make more sense when she does that later and does pass out.
She's like a blaster that like has to recharge in between blasts or something, and then they have to like, you know, protect her passed out body and like carry her around and stuff for a couple of minutes until she wakes back up and regenerates.
Yeah, well, I mean, they didn't even need to be that severe, but like with breaking the martini glass, if they had been less subtle and done something where she was more purposefully destroying something or, you know, pushing someone or something to a lesser degree.
Is that the scene where Harley's getting blackout drunk and then almost gets kidnapped?
Yeah, if she had used it in that scene, just like a fraction of it, just for like one guy
or
something.
Like a guy is like creeping on her or something and like holding a bottle or something, and she kind of like sees that out of the corner of her eye and like blasts a little volume there to like shatter it and, you know, get the guy off of drunken Harley or something. Like that would have been a way to sort of like hint at like, oh, this is intentional and I can target it and whatever, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And you know, and she could have had a line about how she can't use it all the time or something, whatever. Like, because if she does that, then the audience would be just like waiting for her to do it in every scene she's in. So
it's like Iron Man in Iron Man 2 when he does the two-handed laser blast and spins in a circle, and John Cheadle's like, why didn't you start with that? He's like, I can only do it once.
Yeah. So
just like that,
it would just be, I think, helpful for the movie going public in general had that been more clear. I understand why it's subtle and, you know, hinted at for fans of the comic books, but at the same time, it does feel like an unnecessarily long tease if you're like waiting the entire time for Black Canary to do the voice thing. But I just it's like the least of the problems with her thing. Like, I feel like Huntress is a more problem ridden character in this, because all of her backstory stuff is loaded in at the very end, right before we need to start wrapping up the movie and having our final battle and doing all that. So I don't find it also, to be helpful.
In the scene where they show the Bertinelli family being massacred and there's a little girl in there, was there any assumption other than that little girl is the crossbow killer? Like, they don't explicitly say it until way later. But, like, I think they're trying to, like, convince us that, oh, no, they killed this whole family, including the girl, in that first flashback. And we absolutely know that's not true.
Yeah, I would have to say that I didn't really glom onto that until when they were going back and doing the whole thing of, like, oh, she was a little girl. And I was like, oh, this is her walking into the room where they all get shot. And then she does a few seconds later. And then she has a Ferrari car, which is a toy, which she's holding on to not be scared. But that lasts like 2 seconds. They're all murdered except for her. The one guy feels bad about it, sends her to Sicily, Godfather style. And she's raised by that guy's father and brother to be an assassin. And I found this exposition very derailing, because this is after the bonding that we were witnessing between Cassandra Cain and Harley. Like, they just done the grocery store stuff and all that other business. Like, to have us take a break from all of that to go over here to do this thing for revealing why somebody has been killing somebody with crossbow bolts for the entire run of the picture, I just don't think it flowed. And I don't think her story sits in well, despite the fact that it is about this diamond. And despite the fact they talk about the crossbow killer at several points in the film, it doesn't tie in because it's so late in the reveal process for that. And they don't do a good job of explaining it once she meets all of them, because the first time she really meets them is in that final battle, like, room where they've, you know, have Chris Messina. She kills Chris Messina, and then they talk about it some more, and she's like, I can go now, like, I'm done with this whole thing, you guys can argue or whatever.
Yeah, she seems the least invested in finding the diamond and the numbers in the whole thing. Like, she doesn't even really bring it up.
No, I don't think she knows about it. But
you don't think she knows about the numbers in the diamond?
It's not evident from the film that she knows that.
I agree, but, like, yeah, you're saying that Harley knew that the numbers were on the diamond and out of the goodness of her heart gave those numbers to Huntress so she could use them for the other stuff, but then she decided to be a little stinker and keep the diamond.
We don't know, because we also don't know that Harley knew the numbers were there at all, that maybe she, like, it is not clear how she knew and how she relayed that information and how she kept the diamond and how she pawned the diamond.
Who, like, said the thing about the yeah, numbers in the movie, though?
She says it in voiceover.
Right.
That's it. So we only have her narrative voice in the past tense to go on, and we don't know when that happened in the course of the events of the picture. So who knows in the picture is not clear. And who knows and when in the course of the events of the picture is also not clear. But somebody had to have told Harley before she pawned the diamond, because otherwise they wouldn't have the account numbers. And Harley would have had to tell them the account numbers in order for them to get access to the stuff offshore.
Yes.
Because they didn't have the diamond in their possession to like go, oh, I wonder if there's account numbers engraved on this. Like they, so there needed to be some communication at some point about that. But it's not in, it's not depicted on screen in the film. And, you know, it's possible it doesn't need to be, but at the same time, it is sort of like a head scratching move of like, how did that happen at the end? Like, why?
It had to happen between like when the little girl went to the bathroom at the taco place, and then like the next scene where they're like pawning it or whatever, because there's nothing else that occurs in the film between those two things. But and you would think, listening to this, as I briefly thought to myself a moment ago, why are we spending so much time trying to unpack the nature of this diamond and when there are numbers and what, who knew what and when? It's because that's basically the whole plot of the movie, aside from, you know, the little bit of backstory about the characters and their lives and Harley getting, well, dumped by the Joker and trying to stand on her own and finding her own identity. The plot of this story is Sionis has/loses the diamond and wants it back, and also wants to kill Harley and uses this as an opportunity to maybe like have her go on a kamikaze mission to recover the diamond, and then if she doesn't, the other guys will get it and she'll get killed, and you know, he'll two birds one stone or whatever. But like, yeah, the plot of the story is making friends whilst trying to recover a diamond that has stuff on it that I forgot even happened there.
Yeah, well, I would say you're kind of giving short shrift to the, like, down with the patriarchy, you know, pro-self-worth stuff that's in here. And like,
oh, sure, there's a lot of that there, but yeah. that's the character stuff, not so much the actual plot mechanics of, like, what they're on a mission to go do.
Yeah, I would say the character stuff is what propels the movie more than what the plot is doing. Like, because like you said,
sure,
the plot stuff is sort of silly and inconsequential.
Right, but like without the diamond,
yeah,
it's just kind of a character study, which is interesting enough. But like at the end of the movie, you're just like, why did all of that happen? And even more so for me, because while watching it, apparently I missed all of the stuff about account numbers. So I thought it was just a really valuable diamond, and then it was just character stuff that fit in there. And again, I still think that was entertaining, but like, as a whole, like I guess it's good that we're not fighting another Earth/New York consuming monster from another dimension beast thing. The stakes are much lower, which are always better movies, but the stakes are so low. It's just like, we lost a diamond, please recover the diamond, and or, you know, account numbers. But I missed that part.
Well, I would say that the stakes are also, everyone's after Harley. And so how does she deal with this problem? Of like, there, people are going to come after me, and I'm not protected by the Joker, and I've provoked a lot of people. There is a thing every time somebody shows up where it says the person's name, and what their grievance is. In a freeze
frame. Which is a funny setup. Like, there's not really much of a conclusion or punchline to that. Like at the end of the movie, she doesn't like stand up on top of a building and go like, haha, I've showed you all that I don't need the Joker because I'm strong enough on my own, so don't at me, guys, because I'll beat you up and I don't even need the Joker.
I mean,
like we kind of intuit that based on this the premise, but like it doesn't end in a resolved state for her. Basically,
it sort of does. She has sort of that line of talking when she is going out on Founders Pier after Cassandra Cain and Roman, because Roman offers to protect her, and she says, "Oh, that's the kind of protection that Mr. J would provide me."
Right.
And you know, like it's that I forget what her exact wording is, but it's like
at a cost. Something like people are. You want me to do that because people are scared of you, but people should actually be scared of me.
Yes. And so she realizes, this is the part where she like realizes her own self-worth here, that she doesn't need anybody else's protection, and that she can stand on her own two feet without being subservient to someone else.
Right. And are we to assume that sort of the underworld catches wind of the fact that she killed Sionis, which kind of moves her up in the food chain as far as mob boss politics are concerned, and she kind of assumes the respect that he had across the city. Because, like, what is the impact of her newfound self-worth on the rest of the criminals? Like, are they going to stop coming at her because they're like, oh, I saw what she did to that guy over there, and I don't want none of that? Or are they just going to be like, I didn't get that newsletter, so let's go kill her because we're still mad about that stuff?
Well, presumably, if this movie had done well enough to have a sequel, we would have the answer for that.
Well, maybe we'll get a line or two of dialogue in the inevitable team-building montage in The Suicide Squad.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm sort of fearful for what that will bring. In the trailer, I don't know if you remember this, but the trailer was largely about, like, breaking Harley out of some place, and she had already broken herself out of the thing. So I don't know what that's about. But in terms of this particular film, I think that she probably would have spread the word that she got rid of Roman Sionis, and that she has that ability, should anybody come to threaten her again. But she also has a self-confidence that I don't think she would necessarily back down from anybody else who would challenge her. Whereas before, she was sort of fearful during the events of this film whenever somebody would show up to come after her. I feel like she probably has some more self-confidence in that regard. And I think that it's also interesting in terms of her decisions to be a less terrible person, as she puts it, in that it is not that she is a good person by the end of the picture, and she hasn't joined up with the Birds of Prey group.
And frankly, her messaging about, like, to the girl, like, sorry about trying to give you up, I guess I'm just a terrible person. It's like, well, not necessarily a terrible person based specifically on that act, because you kind of didn't have any other options. You were about to be killed by a large group of people, and this was basically your only way out, and you're going to, you know, we know you're going to try and weasel your way out of this in general, but you let down the poor little girl. That doesn't necessarily make you a terrible person, but sure, whatever.
I mean, I would say all of the other events of her life have made her a terrible person.
Yes, not so much that particular event.
Yeah, I mean, because the movie starts with her getting a hyena, and she gets it by feeding the hyena owner to the hyena.
Well, you know, you ask a lady buying a hyena to pay in sex, that's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I'll take payment in kind. And then he's been his legs being gnawed on in the little living room. I don't know what you feel about Cassandra Cain. I was kind of hoping for a little more with her. I know child actors are tough, but I did like that they sort of made her this expert pickpocket, but also incredibly naive in every other way, so that she seems immature and inexperienced.
She's got the get out of my room mom vibe going on, mm-hmm. but that's about it.
Yeah, she's a rebellious teen, but she doesn't have the knowledge to really, you know, take care of herself as much as she thinks that she does. And the scenes with her and Harley together more than some of the other stuff that was happening in the picture, because I feel like it gives Harley an opportunity to sort of espouse what it is that she thinks or believes in, and sort of like challenge some stuff that she thinks about herself, and that it also gives us the opportunity to explore why she would, you know, want to like be a little soft in terms of like dealing with this kid. She doesn't want to, when she finds out that the kid has the diamond and has eaten it, she wants to give the kid like laxatives and prune juice and stuff like that to make the kid poop it out. She doesn't want to gut the kid. That's not her first go-to. But she does threaten the kid with, you know, if I have to, we could do the other way. And she says she'll, you know, watch out for her until she does this thing, then look at the diamond, and then everything will be fine. So she obviously is not trying to just murder this kid in a blind rage. And I think that helps develop the character in terms of making her more likable and less random as well. Because in the rest of the picture before meeting her, she's very flighty in terms of what she's concerned with and what her priorities are. And giving,
she's still fairly flighty in the sense that, like, she's willing to do this to get the diamond to sort of like get Roman off her back, but she's not like particularly invested in the diamond beyond that. Like, she's not looking for a score here. She's not looking to like outfox anyone in particular. She's just trying to like, whatever, get Roman off her back and onto the next breakfast sandwich or whatever, which is a plot point we haven't talked about yet.
No, but it is. But I think that this is what provides this movie with structure, a better through line for getting at character development for Harley is giving her someone to directly act against so that she can explain things to, because it makes her talk in a linear fashion, where it is not just about cracking a joke to get from that scene to the next scene or something, or about, you know, committing some violent act in order to get rid of somebody. Like, she has this kid to deal with, and so she has to talk to the kid in multiple scenes strung together, which is very helpful, because she, Harley, by herself, is not going to talk this coherently in the picture with anybody else. It gives her a better sense of purpose, and also helps us sort of like get into what it is that she's thinking in this process, when it comes to like her thoughts on the Joker and her thoughts on crime and her thoughts on like what to do about like interpersonal relationships and stuff with the people you work with, and you know, it's not personal, it's business and stuff, all this stuff. Like, she gives us that avenue to tap into that stuff by having Cassandra Cain in the picture. I just wish there was more stuff to Cassandra Cain. I don't feel like she has as much going on internally. She's not as bad as like Wesley Crusher or that kid from RoboCop 3, but it's
she's just a human conveyance of the diamond, frankly, who doesn't want to be cut open.
She is, as Harley says in her voiceover, a complication, because she ate the diamond. But the it could have been, I think, just a little better. Especially if they tap into anything that had to do with the foster family that she didn't like, or with what it is that she wants from the world, other than to be like a badass crime boss, like Harley, who everybody respects.
Yeah, they bond over her, what Harley thinks is a depressing apartment, a single lady apartment above the whatever restaurant, and Cassandra very much enjoys what appears to be like the adult version of a cool kid's bedroom kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I like when they're gonna eat some cereal, and she takes the two bowls and she just dumps out the congealed cereal that's in there, and then just refills them with more cereal and milk.
Wipes amazing. Off two spoons that were already sitting on the table.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. In between the vodka bottles, I thought that was. Why there are two vodka bottles, I'm not entirely clear on, but I liked just sort of this disarray and that bonding experience.
Everyone's got their priorities.
Yeah, the Beaver, I never really caught on to that as a funny thing. And the hyena, unfortunately, I feel like is underutilized. I don't know if I've ever said that about a picture.
The hyena is underutilized.
Yeah, because it's just, I was expecting it to be involved in some of the action scenes, to be perfectly honest with you, but I guess it just was too expensive or something, because they're just like, well, it lives in this apartment. It's gone missing from this explosion, and we'll see it at the end of the picture. Yeah.
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 For some reason, I thought there were two hyenas. Maybe I made that up in my...
There are two hyenas in the cartoon show, and I don't remember their names, but because Harley's originally from the cartoon, Batman the Animated Series is where she was created by Paul Dini and Bruce Timm, she has some interesting stuff in the cartoon, and she was so well-liked in the cartoon that she was added to the comics after that. For example, Black Mask apparently dates back to like 1985, whereas Harley Quinn you know, is introduced in the Batman the Animated Series in like 1990 or 1991 or something, and is in the comics in like the late 90s. And so it's just like she I think has had a far more impactful presence on terms of like popular culture and stuff because of
just talking about a guy from the 80s who's holding a mirror up to the people who have their own masks in society versus quirky Joker girl. So
yeah, and I like the character of Harley Quinn, but I liked her more when I was younger and watching Batman the Animated Series. And then as I got older and I thought about it, I was like, oh, this is bad. This is a bad relationship she's in. She shouldn't be with this guy. It's not good. But they have
when you're young, she's basically an animaniac or a freakazoid type character. When you're older, you're like, oh, this is codependence and abuse and things.
Yeah. But yes, to your point, there were two hyenas in the cartoon. Again, I wonder if that is like the money situation, because
you just copy paste, right?
Yeah, you just copy and paste the hyena.
You just duplicate a hyena and offset it in time a couple of frames so the motion isn't the same.
Also, it'd be, I think, far more difficult to justify the absence of two hyenas in the picture later on and stuff. I feel like
when it gets blown up out the window?
Yeah. I feel like there's just more work that would need to be done in order to justify having two hyenas in the movie when you can barely justify having the one.
Would you say it would require twice as much work?
I would say it's probably more than twice, because
exponential hyenas.
Yeah. I mean, this is a situation where two is probably like four or five, because you're going to have them interacting with each other. You're going to have one of them in all of the scenes, because you can't explain why they're both not in the scenes if you blow up her apartment. So, you know, it's a lot more work.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed the hyena that we got.
Well, you go to the box office with the hyena that you have, not the hyena that you want.
Gift hyena in the mouth.
No, it'll gnaw on your leg. But I have to say that Cassandra Cain, the hyena, the apartment, fine, whatever. But we don't dwell on that for very much time, if at all. And it could have been better, I think, maybe to have some more scenes of them building a relationship together. It is terminated by that rather confusing scene where there's a knock on the door and it's Gotham PD, and then she panics and then she goes to go out the window, and then there's a guy with a ball of explosives and a slingshot on the back of his truck who is hurling that towards her apartment window. Presumably, he's the one who knocked on the door, that he was Gotham PD, and then fired this so that he would know that they were there before he fired the slingshot.
Maybe what's his name sold her out to a bunch of different people who all just happened to get there at the same time.
Yeah, but there is no conflict that is revealed other than that guy, and where that guy goes after that scene we don't know, because they just walk out of the apartment building where there's some like burning debris and stuff, and walk over to the minivan where what's his name, Doc, I want to say. He's loading up all of his stuff so that he can get out of there, because he was given enough money to have a really nice restaurant now, and that it's not personal, it's just business. And that's the character motivation that makes her agree to do the amusement park thing. But it's weird in terms of the flow of that scene, because they go from bonding on the couch to Gotham PD to explosion to on the street to I betrayed you, but it's nothing personal, it's just business. And it's all like a couple, like just like a minute or two that all unfolds. And I don't think that was well explained in terms of the timing or the geography or where any of the people who were assaulting them went, because it's just resolved and wrapped up. And like the hyena is gone, oh well, and that's it. And then they find it wandering around Chinatown later in the picture. And so I don't understand that evolution of that scene. It bothers me, because I feel like that is pretty integral in order to making the storytelling make sense in a fluid manner. But
they probably just cut out a couple scenes of her kicking some people and hitting them with bats and stuff, you know.
I guess. Yeah, but they
Oh, Cassandra Cain is a comic book character too?
Yes.
My God.
Cassandra Cain is Batwoman, I want to say.
Yeah, but she's in a bat-like costume. I'm hovering over here.
Yeah, but it's a completely different depiction from what you see inside of this film. So I don't know why she's named Cassandra Cain in the film. Because it seems unrelated, but whatever.
Is Black Mask in the cartoon or comic books, is he, does he have a skull face? Is he like Red Skull, or is that just a really creepy looking mask he's wearing there?
I think it initially starts out as a really creepy mask, but in some depictions of him, it is damage to his face that's made permanent, or the mask is bonded onto his face. I can't remember exactly, but he's, the start of his character is it's a mask. So that's the important part, I guess.
I think his mask is stupid looking.
I mean, I don't really care. I think the mask in the movie looks stupid. Yeah. I think the mask in the comic looked scarier. I think in the movie, he just kind of looks like a Mexican wrestler, I guess. Like it's just sort of this, like, this leather mask thing with a bunch of like detailing on it. It doesn't really read as like anything ominous. I think as much as they tried to make it seem ominous. I like when he puts it on in his weird closet where there's the painting, the mural of all the people on the walls where they have like white bodies with like skull heads and like alternating in patterns and stuff. Like I thought that was like a nice shot, like design wise, but in terms of the mask itself, especially as depicted in the rest of what happens, it doesn't matter, and it gets knocked off of his face in classic comic book movie fashion because you want to have your actors emote on screen, and they can't do that through that.
Yeah, there's a reason he doesn't wear the mask until the end of the movie. It's because we want to see Ewan McGregor doing things that he does in this movie.
Yeah. Even when he's wearing eyeliner, which is just a weird choice.
That's the scene where he makes the lady get on the table and stuff.
Yeah. He's very unhinged. But, you know, with all this going on, Montoya has an obsession with him and wants to, you know, bust all the crime in Gotham, basically. All the crime, every crime, all busted. That's her motivation, and she's out to prove herself because, she busted some cases, and her captain took credit for it. Her partner, who became her captain, took credit for it, and so now she is very defensive about that, and sort of dwells on that as a failure. And it seems to have caused her to spiral into alcoholism at several points in her life, including in the events of this film. And her ex-girlfriend is Ali Wong, which I just sort of chuckled at when I saw Ali Wong on screen, and I was just like, sure, she's the assistant DA and their ex-girlfriend, so that's fine. But not that Ali Wong does anything funny or meaningful, really, in the course of the events of the film. It's just an interesting casting choice.
She plays that character straight.
No, in her resolution, Montoya's resolution to all of this is that she knows better than anyone else what they got to do in order to bust crime, and that she's going to go do that, and she doesn't need the approval of anybody else, and she doesn't need to run it past anybody, and she doesn't need anybody weighing in on that or taking credit from her for that. So that's why she finally quits and why she goes to work with the Birds of Prey.
Vigilante justice time.
Yeah. And you know, it's understandable from the, stuff we see depicted in the film. Although there are a couple questionable moments where you're just like, maybe you are kind of a loose cannon, for not putting that in evidence, and instead running it to the DA. I think that maybe you shouldn't have done that, but you know, it's definitely a situation where she is stifled by her superior. I thought for sure that there would be some moment where we find out that her superior is on the take for Black Mask or something.
Yeah, it's this weird balance between ineptitude and maybe he's corrupt or something, but it turns out he's just dumb.
Yeah, not just dumb. He is risk averse, but when something works out in his favor, he takes credit for it.
Sure.
So, like all good bosses.
That's management for you.
Yeah. Management 101. Say no to everything. When someone does it anyways and it works out, then kudos to you, because you get to take credit for that. But
if it doesn't work out, you can throw them under the bus.
Yeah. You say they should never should have done that and you never approve the project. So, you know, it's just it's fun that you can do that. But I thought that was fine. Rosie Perez, you know, certainly played a hardened cop fine.
Like, is better or worse than her portrayal of a cop in Pineapple Express?
Man, I forgot that she was in Pineapple Express. I guess I would say better. I think that she plays a cop who's down on her luck really well. I didn't buy her stamina in the fighting scene at the end, but I appreciated that they were willing to go there with her. But it read as a little false that she was holding her own in hand-to-hand combat, given what we saw previously. But I did like her, and I thought that in terms of her like dialogue scenes, she does a good job of being this hardened, cynical cop. And I was totally fine with that. And I think that concludes like all of our major like characters in this this thing. And it all just really comes down to like the flow of events that reveals and pushes them around the sort of like game board of a movie.
Yeah.
The
general arcing plot of the movie, the way things are assembled, is kind of a mess, but this is still a fairly entertaining film.
Yeah. And I would say that I didn't, like I said at the beginning, this isn't a good film and it's not a bad film. I feel like it could have been a much better film had the editing been changed for some of this. If you had made a couple more of the character backgrounds integrated into the linear story that was going on instead of jumping around, I think that it would have helped us build stuff around the story and around the characters in a linear fashion where everybody's on sort of the same footing and the same page as we move through it, as opposed to jumping around where I feel like you're not giving your characters a chance to relate to each other in an ensemble. I feel like that hurts your ensemble because, like we said with Huntress, she really doesn't come into this until the very final fight. And when that happens, then they all are a group really working and talking through things. Prior to that, she didn't communicate with any of them. Not a single other character in this film, in the main cast, she didn't talk to one of them. And so I didn't appreciate that at all, especially when you find out the acting choices they chose for her were actually kind of entertaining, that she is this extremely skilled killer but doesn't really understand humor or interpersonal relationships or anything like that. I thought that kind of twist that they gave on her would have been much better if you could have used that earlier in the film, and so I would have liked to have seen her more deftly woven into what we're doing than just popping in at the end for the final fight. And that's kind of how I feel, you know, just in general. It's just like, just make it more of like a story that's around this thing where you're building towards something as opposed to this story that happens incidentally to the introductions of these other characters that are in the story at the end. So that's just kind of how I feel about that.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and on that note,
Are we allowed to ask where you rank this compared to some of the other DC things yet?
Oh, sure. I mean, I will give the qualifier of the, I believe the official moniker is the DC Extended Universe. Of those, which I believe starts with Man of Steel, which I have not seen, and, you know, the various other pictures.
You don't have to go through all of it. So is it better than Suicide Squad? The first one?
I think this is better than Suicide Squad.
Okay.
I feel like Suicide Squad could not have been this movie. And I feel like this movie could not have been Suicide Squad, just in terms of tone and what you're doing and the story you're telling. And I agree with you.
You've got that weird monster lady making lights in the sky. That's different than finding a diamond.
Yeah, I feel like it's just an entirely different set of circumstances to deal with in terms of writing and directing. So I don't want to just like put them next to each other and be like, oh, they both have Harley Quinn and they're the same movie. Because they're not. But I feel like the difficulty is interesting because I feel like the stakes are higher for this movie than they were for the first Suicide Squad movie.
You mean because, like, in terms of critical reception and success?
Yes. I feel like this movie was not as set up for success as Suicide Squad was. Because Suicide Squad...
You thought they were hitting a grand slam with Suicide Squad and it was a huge flop, and this one they were like, people might like this, and it turned out to be pretty good.
Well, I feel like this movie theoretically lost money, which is kind of sad.
I think all movies in the future are going to lose money because they're comparing them to cinema release only, and that's not really going to happen anymore. But anyway, continue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for the purposes of this, you know, when it was released, it made 75%, I believe, of what Suicide Squad made when it came out. So even though this was a lower budget film than that was, it's a huge drop off. And I know that there are some theorizing about the reasons for that, etc. But I believe pretty firmly that this movie was not favorably received because of the lesser status that some people might assign to an all-female cast.
You don't think it was just because Suicide was a flop and a lot of people were like, this can't honestly be any better than that?
Well, that could be a contributing factor, but I feel like these aren't the big name characters in this picture.
There was no big buff man in spandex punching people in this movie, so people weren't going to tune in for it.
Yes. I feel like because this movie doesn't have the Joker, because this movie doesn't have Batman, because this movie doesn't tease that it's, you know, intricately woven into the events of further Justice League films, I feel like that the movie is less necessary for some people. And I feel like the movie also hurt itself because this is an R-rated picture. And that desire to have that level of violence also probably turned off people who would otherwise consider seeing it, either younger people or people who are just perhaps not as into violence on screen, but who may have liked the interpersonal relationships between the characters. I feel like it could have benefited from being a little just opened up just a tiny bit more. I feel like there's an obsession, especially with the DC movies, of being like really violent and you know, it's got like such a hardcore rating, man. And I don't know why this movie needed it.
We're not afraid to go there, guys.
Yeah, it doesn't seem necessary. It doesn't seem like it. Even watching this film and thinking back on it, I'm like, what was the R-rated part? Like, there's some blood and people exploded and things, but like, what was the R-rated part?
Backwards, which happens to two separate people.
Yeah, but like, is that R-rated or is that PG-13? Like, where does that even fall in the rating system? I don't know. Yeah. I've seen some pretty violent PG-13 movies, but true. Usually it's just like pew pew pew, like that level of violence where there's like glowing bolts.
There's a couple F-words in this movie, so maybe that contributed.
Yeah, that could be it.
So on the topic of you saying people might consider this potentially skippable, do you feel like this was useful to do between the various Suicide Squad movies, since I was the one who sort of said we should probably watch this in between the two?
Well, since neither of us have watched the movie after this, sure.
I mean, do you feel like you gained some sort of insight or understanding about her character, which I guess might propel us into the next movie in some way?
I feel like it will help us better form a critique of the next movie.
About how James Gunn underutilized her based on all of the things that were set up in the previous film.
Well, that could be the case, or, you know, maybe he does a good job with her or something. I don't know. But it is certainly true that if we had gone with Suicide Squad and the Suicide Squad back to back, we would be left wondering what was the missing part here. Like, how did the two connect or relate? And like, was there something in between that was actually better than what's in either one? And we wouldn't have had that knowledge.
Yeah, it also helps because it says, you know, I've seen some people mention online that James Gunn is sort of aping the aesthetic of this movie, so he's not really bringing his Guardian stuff, and people giving him credit for doing what he's doing for the DC universe should really be giving credit to Kathy Ann.
Yeah, I saw that criticism as well. I'm reserving judgment until I watch the film. Also, I don't know how Kathy Ann feels about any of this, but I think that she...
Are you telling me she hasn't put an Apple Notes screenshot up on Twitter yet?
No, I don't think she's done that.
Restore the Yan cut. Let's get it trending.
She hasn't done that either. She like mused, I think, where was it on the Wikipedia page? Yeah, here it is. Talking about post-production process, Kathy Yan indicated that she would have loved to have more control over the edit, but that's just kind of how it is. I don't know if there's a Kathy Yan cut out there, but I think for any filmmaker, all of us are in it because we want to express ourselves as wholly as possible and to match what you ultimately see on screen with what's in our head. So, you know,
it's a very diplomatic way of saying this didn't quite meet the mark.
Yeah, but I feel like she doesn't seem angry at anyone or pointing fingers at anyone or anything like that.
Impotent rage is sort of generally reserved for male directors who are criticized publicly.
Yeah, I think it was a very diplomatic thing for her to say. I would like to see more stuff that she does, for sure. Whether or not it's another one of these, I don't know. But I feel like she certainly has artistic choices that she makes that I find more compelling than some of the banal choices that David Ayer made in the previous film. I find Ayer, his direction, his aesthetic, his desires visually for what he wants to be dull and not exciting and to sort of come from a place where it's written as this seems badass for someone who is in college. I don't feel like he has an evolved aesthetic for what he wants. I feel like Kathy Yan, while having a very full of stimulants kind of vibe for this, she had more of an aesthetic style that I found interesting to watch. And I thought that she got interesting performances out of people, despite the fact that I don't find any of the dialogue really truly memorable in this. I feel like that was an accomplishment, and I would like to see more from her in that regard. I'm not going to, you know, this is not like a full-throated defense of her saying like, oh, her vision is like 1,000 times better than all these other DC directors, because I don't really think that's the case. But I feel like she's certainly much more interesting than I've seen from other people who are involved in these sort of superhero movies. So I'd like to see more of that personal touch that she has.
Yeah, the movie was certainly more fun than others we had seen. So would you like to discuss my VFX note in this part of the show or in the after show?
Let's discuss your VFX note, unless it's something highly personal.
Yeah, so this is something that stuck out to me the first time I saw the movie, and when I saw it again in this one, I was like, yep, that's a thing we have to talk about. So the final frame of this movie, after they have hawked the diamond and she gives the guy her business card that says Harley Quinn and Associate, and she hops back in the car with the little girl, and they're getting ready to drive away in their fancy new outfits with the hyena in the back, the little girl hands her the breakfast sandwich that she lost when she was tackled by the cop. I guess it was Rosie Perez in the beginning of the movie, and she was heartbroken when she was hungover, and they sniff their arm hair and stale cheese sandwich lovingly. The camera moves in as she's driving and unwraps it and takes a large bite out of the sandwich, which is absolutely a CG bite. And it stuck out to me immediately. I'm imagining you saw it as well. But I would just like to discuss what they shot there and why they did that. I believe they pre-cut the mouth shape out of the sandwich and then painted the sandwich back in so she could take a clean bite without messing up her makeup or getting sandwich in her teeth or whatever and making it look nice. And then the, you know, the shadow of the teeth that they painted over the sandwich is really the thing that sticks out the most.
I think I may have not been intently staring at this.
I wasn't even looking directly at it. I was just kind of watching the screen and something stuck out and he was like, what was that? And I rewound and looked at it again. And I was like, that's not what's happening here.
I mean, you're probably right that it was a bite that had been taken and they just painted it back in. I don't know, ease of filming or lack of sandwiches on set. Because sometimes when you have food on set, Dan, I don't know if you know this, but you have to prepare the food.
Yeah.
And then you put it out there. And if you don't have somebody out there preparing like another round of food, then they can't keep going. They can't keep shooting. They have to stop everything.
It's usually often very old and unappealing food, but that's typically why somebody will take a bite of something and then spit it into a bucket off frame. But this is just one where they clearly opted for some computer magics and trickeries. So if you get a spare 5 minutes, just fire that up on your internet device of choice and then take a look at that and let me know what you think, because I caught it twice now, even though I immediately forgot everything about this movie after the first time, but I watched it again this other time. I was like, oh yeah, we gotta talk about this.
Okay, well, I'm glad
people of the internet, if you saw what I saw and I'm not just crazy, at me on Twitter and tell me I saw the sandwich bite. Or don't. I don't know.
Hashtag I saw the sandwich bite.
Let's get this trending, people. Restore the sandwich bite cut.
Yeah. And no one will be able to hide from this political disaster.
That's all I got then.
We neglected to mention this earlier. So I'll say this as part of our wrap up of visual things that were not great. This movie takes place in Los Angeles. It is supposed to be Gotham City, but it is 100% Los Angeles in all of these shots that you see. It is LA. And it is bright, sun bleached, and full of LA landmarks. They tried to adjust for that in a couple of shots. There's a shot where they're driving over what I believe is the 8th Street Bridge. And you're looking at downtown from the direction of driving from Boyle Heights, and you see a CG elevated train that they added to the other side of the bridge or overpass. And then you see the sign over the bridge that says Financial District instead of saying whatever it is that it says there. I wish they had put in more effort into making this seem like Gotham. LA is not Gotham, and it doesn't ever look like Gotham, unless you're filming it at night. And to film it like in broad daylight like this, while it gives the movie a different vibe, it does draw attention to the fact that it is Los Angeles, including the skyline and everything else. I don't feel like they adjusted enough for that. You also have some of the other sort of questionable choices in terms of the amusement park, where there's this abandoned amusement park, which had apparently been used as a hideout by the Joker and Harley at some point in the past. But the hideout itself leads to an amusement area. I will not call it a ride, but it is a thing where there is a spinning platform with rubber hands, enormous rubber hands. There is next to that a set of mirrors set up sort of like Hall of Mirrors, but like is like fragments with like stalactites and stuff, so that you have stuff sort of at eye level and up and down and stuff and you can walk through. And then there is also another area where there is these sort of like wiggling tongue things that you can jump on top of and bounce around on. They're apparently sturdy enough for that. And a sort of like tube of lights and a slide that dumps you down there from an upper story that is ill-defined in terms of why anyone would be up there. And it kind of bothers me when I'm watching the action scene take place inside of this environment, because it seems tailored for the action scene and doesn't seem to be a ride or an attraction. It doesn't feel like it's a haunted house or anything like that where people would be jumping out. It doesn't feel like there's, you know, any other element. It's not like a boat ride or anything. It's not any other sort of like dark room thing. It is just a bunch of random stuff that is vaguely carnival circus themed inside of a room. And I sort of got bothered by that, especially when you're watching people just jumping back and forth in the action between the various locations. I wish that had made a little more sense in terms of what was happening for them progressing out of there. Had it been a ride where they needed to get from one end of the ride to the other and encountered things along the way, instead of just being one big round room, that may have made it make a little more sense than it currently makes. That's just an enormous
cool
room.
Camera stuff where like somebody hits somebody with something and then they duck, and then the other character swings something over their head and hits somebody else, and then they duck, and then another character kicks over top of their head, and et cetera.
Yeah. And then they duck. No, but I didn't care for that. And the Founders Pier thing with the heavy CG fog and stuff. I get what they were going for, but again, it doesn't feel like that sits at all with the rest of the city that we've seen.
Did they use deep compositing there, Joe? Do you think they used some deep compositing?
I don't. I would assume that they did not. But it's just one of those things where it's just like, this doesn't fit with any of the other stuff that you've shown us for what this Gotham is inside of this picture.
What about the big chemical matte painting that blows up?
Well, that fit perfectly because I think they reused that from Suicide Squad. It just adjusted it slightly.
Yeah.
Because it is the same round bulbousy thing. But yeah, it's just a little. Just a little weird because it's just so downtown Los Angeles and stuff with some other things, appendages like glued onto it in terms of making it seem like it's not Los Angeles. And it just, it doesn't work.
I mean, did Suicide Squad really feel Gotham-y? I mean, I feel like that was also LA.
Well, that wasn't Gotham. No, it was, what was it? Midway City or something. Anyway, it's supposed to be some. Yeah, it's supposed to be some generic, this is pseudo Chicago thing. And I believe it was Chicago and Toronto. Like, I think the aerial shots are Chicago and the ground shots are Toronto. That seemed more acceptable for what it was. If they wanted to have a storytelling point in this movie that Harley had left Gotham in order to, like, strike out on her own or something and move to another made-up DC city name, there are many, Opal City, Coast City, blah blah blah, if they wanted to do any of that stuff in order to make that seem more plausible, then maybe that would make sense. It'd also make more sense for why the Joker's not in the film and why Batman's not in the film.
But then you would have the difficulty of all the people that know her and are seeking revenge on her. Why are they there? Did they really travel across the country just to get revenge?
Yeah, I mean, it could be in the comics, there is a city that's near Gotham where Nightwing works out of. I can't remember the name of it. It's like something Haven, whatever. But it's like across the street, basically. But it's just to give them just enough room that they could have another area that another superhero is looking after, another team of superheroes is looking after, but it's so close that you could just like hop on over to Gotham whenever you needed to.
Is that the little place across the bay where Superman fought?
No,
the big monster thing.
No, in Zack Snyder's movie, for some reason, Gotham and Metropolis are across the water from each other.
Sure,
which is so strange. When I watched Dawn of Justice, I was like, I'm sorry, but why are these two cities, these two enormous cities, next to each other like that? Wouldn't it just be one city instead of just being these two things sort of sandwiched together incongruously? Because the vibe of Gotham is very different from the vibe of Metropolis. Is not
one,
the same
one
thing.
Has sunlight, the other doesn't really.
Yeah, this is the side of the river where the sun is always shining, and that's the side of the river where there's constant cloud cover and searchlights and blimps and stuff as they patrol for dangerous fiends. But over here, because we have sunshine, everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's so strange.
Someday
just the choices.
DC will get it together.
I don't think they will. I think that they are idiots.
Well, at least this movie was kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And on that happy note, we will, we look forward, to revisiting our thoughts on this as we wrap it all up with The Suicide Squad. Emphasis on the. Capital T, lowercase h, e. The.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The next one.
The next one. The next time. The next. Same channel?
Probably.
Yes.